to this God-inspired message from Shofar Christian Church. We trust that you will enjoy today's message and that it will encourage you to grow deeper in your relationship with Christ our Savior.
How would you determine whether you're in God's will for you right now? We're talking about the concept of calling and what we are called to do. How would you determine whether you or anyone else for that matter is living out their calling or is busy obeying and walking in God's will for their life? Okay, the reason I ask this is because sometimes I think there are some criteria that are better than others. For example, let's take fruit. I agree that there will be fruit, but the danger is always that we would tend to define that fruit in the wrong way. We'd say, for instance, if I'm successful, that's a kind of fruit. But then we might be tempted to define that success in worldly terms. And it's like, but I'm not being successful in worldly terms, therefore I'm not in God's will for my life and I'm not fulfilling God's calling for me. And you could be very wrong there. On the other hand, if you define fruit in the right way, in a biblical way, then what you're saying is exactly right. The peace one you mentioned, Steph, is also one that could be a bit dangerous in a sense. What if God calls you to do something that you don't want to do? Can he do that? Is he allowed to do that? Has he done that in the past? Is that going to give you peace? Not always. Not initially. Maybe initially you'll have a lot of distress and there'll be this battle inside of you and so on. Eventually, Steph is right, eventually if you are doing God's will, even when it's difficult, you'll have the peace of knowing that you're obeying God and walking in right relationship with Him. But if you take peace just like that without qualifying it, then if God asks you to do something that you don't want to do, then you're not going to have peace with it. And you're going to say, okay, well, that's obviously not God's will for me. Or, you know, these people at work are giving me such a hard time. So I don't have peace about this. You know, there's this constant conflict and difficulty at work. So there's no peace. So clearly this cannot be God's will for me. So I don't think all our criteria, why I'm asking that question is not all our criteria for determining what God's will is are often the best criteria or the most biblical criteria. So let us be very careful. And I think the life of Joseph illustrates that very nicely. So let's just quickly look at that. There are four sort of, one popular way of dividing Joseph's life in four sections, each beginning with a P is, he started off in his father's house and then he went to the pit. And from the pit he went where? To Potiphar's house. And then from Potiphar's house, he went to prison. And then from prison, he went to the palace. Okay, so the pit, Potiphar's house, prison, palace. That was the road that God took Joseph to fulfill God's calling on his life. Now, the long and the short of what I want to share with you, just to sum it up to begin with is, remember, I was speaking in past weeks a lot about working like God, with God, and for God. So if we work like God, with God, and for God in service of others, we're going to see that in Joseph's life. That's important. In service of others, then everything we experience will either fulfill our calling or prepare us for it. And sometimes those are going to be difficult things like Joseph experienced. Sometimes it's going to look like we're dismal failures, like we're not making it, and yet we're still going to be in God's will for us and walking in God's calling for us, at least in preparation for it, like Joseph was in the pit or in prison. I mean, that didn't look like he was really being very successful, was it? And yet that was part of God's will for his life. Okay? So let's look at Joseph in the pit. Let me just read a little portion from Genesis 37. I'm reading from the NIV, and it said, Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This was the account of Jacob. Joseph A young man of 17 was tending flocks with his brothers, the son of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. And of course, from the wife that he loved most, Rachel. And he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. They hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And a few reasons why Joseph's brothers hated him and couldn't speak a kind word to him. I mean, this is bad, you know, in family, you know, things shouldn't be like this, but often it is like this. Firstly, Joseph's father, Jacob, loved him more. So there was a bit of favoritism. He was the favorite. So there was this unfair favoritism. Now, I always say the problem was not that Jacob loved Joseph too much. The problem was that he didn't love the other sons enough. So the solution is not loving Joseph less. It's loving the other sons more. But Jacob loved him more, and his brother saw that. He brought Jacob a bad report of his brothers. So he was a little tattletale, you know. He came, he didn't work in the field as much as them. Part of the preferential treatment he was receiving was that he was stayed at home. He maybe got a better education, all that kind of stuff. And then now and then his dad would send him out to check on his brothers. And then he'll come back and he'll bring back this bad report about them. And obviously they're not going to like it. You know, you're going to tell them, oh, you know, dad, you know, they're supposed to be looking after the sheep, but they're actually out partying, you know, with the Canaanite girls, you know. They're not doing their job properly. And then finally, he had these dreams in which his brothers bowed down to him. I'm just going to read that to you from verse 5, where it says, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to the dream I had. Now, it tells you a little bit about Joseph's character, the fact that he came and sort of flaunted this dream to his brothers, you know, and sort of, you know, he probably put on his technicolor dream coat, his ornamented robe, you know, before he came to tell them, you know, and he stood before them in his nice robe, which only he had and they didn't. And then he told them this dream. He says, they're binding sheaves of grain out in the field, and suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. His brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told his brothers, listen. He said, I had another dream, and this time the sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So we see here that Joseph was hated by his brothers because of all these things. But we also see, and the dream tells us very clearly, that none of the things that happened in Joseph's life after this happened by accident. God had planned it, and God executed it from the beginning. It wasn't an accident. Now, that's a bit hard for us to understand, but we need to, and that's why the dream is told to us right at the beginning, so that we have under no illusion that this was just, you know, sort of chance or accident happening. God had planned it from the beginning. And we'll see that at the end again. So we know what happened. They sold Joseph as a slave, you know. He comes to come and check on his brothers again. And then they're already, you know, upset with him because the last time he checked on them, you know, he brought a bad report, you know, to their dad. So they're already upset with him. And now he's had these dreams as well in which they're going to bow down to the ground before him. So he thinks he's better than us. And they say, oh, here comes the dreamer. Let's kill him. And they actually plot to kill him. And, you know, they have this sort of argument, and Reuben eventually convinces them, the eldest brother, to, no, don't kill him. Just throw him in this pit, this waterless pit, and don't harm him. And eventually the Ishmaelites, guys from Arab descent come around and they slave traders, and they say, okay, well, let's sell him. And they sell him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, and he's taken to Egypt. And they concoct the story. They take his robe and they tear it up in pieces and dip it in a goat's blood and take it to their father and concoct the story that now he's been killed by a wild animal. Now, remember this, and we know from the dreams that this is part of God's calling and will for Joseph's life. God intended him for him to end up in the pit, and God intended him for him to be sold as a slave. Now, how do you think Joseph felt while he was sitting there in the pit? In the center of God's will for his life. How do you think he felt? I just want to read you a passage later on when his brothers think back on that occasion. It's in Genesis 42, verse 21. It says, they told one another, now this is after they went to Egypt, and they met Joseph, and he treated them quite roughly, but they didn't know it was Joseph. And they listened to this. They said to one another, surely we are being punished because of our brother Joseph, that is. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. So in Genesis 37, it sort of just quickly goes over. He was thrown into the pit and he was sold to the slavers. But from that little portion, we see that he was in deep distress. And you can imagine, he's a 17-year-old kid, and his older brothers grab him, rough him up, throw him in a pit, and then decide to sell him as a slave. You can imagine, just imagine how he pleaded with them. Just imagine how he begged them, please, how can you do this? You are my brothers. But their hate, which they felt for him because of all those reasons, and their jealousy because he was being treated better than them, drove them to sell him. They just didn't listen to him. And all his weeping and all his pleading didn't help. Oh, no. If you're in God's will for your life, you won't go through things like that. You won't be in distress. You won't have to plead. You won't be... No. Joseph was in God's will, and he had to do all those things. He had to go through all of that emotional turmoil. You can only imagine how it felt. Imagine being human trafficked, because that's the equivalent basically today. Being grabbed and then, trafficked somewhere and used as a slave. Terrible. In those days, slaves, much like today, today there are as many slaves as there ever was. Everywhere, it's illegal in most countries. There are some Muslim countries in which it's not illegal, but in most countries it is illegal, and yet it doesn't matter. There are still many slaves today. But in those days, slaves had no rights whatsoever, nothing. So he's in the pit, and then he gets sold as a slave in the house of Potiphar, the captain of Pharaoh's guard. And I just want to trace a few themes through this. The first theme I want you to see is the fact that when you're in God's will, or when you're fulfilling God's calling, or being prepared to fulfill God's calling, it's not always pleasant. So you can't use, oh, it's comfortable as a criteria for determining whether you're in God's will. You cannot use, oh, I'm being successful in the eyes of the world as a criteria whether you're in God's will. Okay? Those are wrong, false criteria. They're not going to tell you what God's will is. In Genesis 39, if you have your Bibles open, you can just turn with me into Genesis 39. I'm just going to read verse 3 to 5 for you quickly. So he was taken down to Egypt in verse 1 and sold to Potiphar. Let me read from verse 2. It says in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. And when his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did. Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in his house and in his field. Isn't that amazing? One of the biggest themes in Joseph's life is whether things were going well or whether things were going not so well, whether it was in the pit or in prison or in the palace, the Lord was with him. That is probably the most prominent theme in Joseph's life. And why was Joseph so successful? Why did he make such a massive impact in the history of Israel and in the history of the world for that matter? Not primarily because he was such a smart guy. I mean, clearly he had some skills, right? Like Rudy was saying, you know, God will use you in certain areas in which you have skills. He was a good manager. He was a good steward. And everywhere he goes, we see people putting him in charge to manage things. You know, whether it's in Potiphar's house or in prison or in the palace, he's put in charge to manage things because he's a good manager. But the reason why he's successful as a manager was not primarily because of his talent, but because the Lord was with him. And what's more, not only was the Lord with him, but people could see that the Lord was with him. It says when Potiphar saw that the Lord was with him and that the hand of the Lord was upon him for good. If you're walking with the Lord, if you're a child of God, then people will be able to see that the Lord is with you. And that it's the Lord that's blessing you. When people look at your life, can they see that the Lord is with you? When people look at your life, do they see, wow, you know, are they left with the sense that he's really a competent person? She's really talented. Is that the sense that they're left with? Or are they left with the sense that this one is being successful because the Lord's with him? There's something different about them. Because you can do both. The Lord can be with you, but if you live in such a way that you receive the glory for it, then people are going to look at your life and say, "Wow, this guy's great. You know, he's got the Midas touch. Everything he touches turns to gold, and you're going to get the credit for it." Or you can do what it says in Matthew, I think it's Matthew chapter 5. Let your good works so shine before men that they may glorify your Father in heaven. You can do good works in a way that will glorify you, or you can do good works in a way that will glorify your Father. And here Joseph was, he comes and he serves. Notice he's serving in Potiphar's house. And the Lord is with him. Did they worship the Lord, Yahweh? That word, the Lord, in our English translation, written with all caps, is a translation of the Hebrew Yahweh. Did they worship Yahweh in Egypt? So how did Potiphar know that it was Yahweh that was blessing Joseph? That's an important question, right? That's an important question. We're going to get to it. Just now. So Joseph was serving, but he was serving in a way that people could see the Lord was with him. There's something about this guy. So Joseph served faithfully, and I just want to read to you from chapter 39, verse 6 to 10, because this is very interesting. It says, so he left Joseph in Joseph's care, everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." That's obviously euphemistically speaking for, you know, let's have sex. Yeah. But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in his house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, she was very persistent. She didn't give up. Day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or to even be with her. He avoided her just to be safe. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak. He tore himself away from her, left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called, then she screamed. So he first ran out and then she screamed. She called his household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew." See what she's doing? This is, I love the psychology that is captured here in the Bible, you know. In order to separate him from the rest of the servants, she says, "Look, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us." So he's a Hebrew now. He's not like you, you know. He's this, we're Egyptians, and this Hebrew has been brought to us, and now he's been put in charge over all of us. This guy is different from us. And look what he's done now, she says. "He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed." She lies. She said she first screamed and then he ran. No. It was the other way around. He first ran and then she screamed. But she just twists it around a little bit, you know. "I screamed. And when he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." She kept the cloak, and we know the story, what happened, of how, just by the way, that's one of the reasons I find the Bible so believable. It's so true to human nature, isn't it? Isn't that exactly what someone would do in a situation like that? Now, you must understand the situation, you know. Joseph is a slave. Yes, he's being made the steward of the household and put in charge of the whole household. So he's been given authority, but he's still a slave who has a master. And this is his master's wife. And his master's wife is telling him to do something that he knows is wrong. Aren't we sometimes faced with situations like that in the workplace? Where someone who has authority over us tells us to do something that is wrong. What do you do in a situation like that? It's not that easy. Joseph chose to do the right thing. And by the way, I don't think this lady was ugly. She was probably quite a looker, you know? And she was probably wearing one of those biblical dresses, you know? Lo and behold. And she was persistent. She wasn't giving up. She was day after day, you know? She was trying to get Joseph, you know? And she was putting pressure on him and trying to seduce him. But he kept saying no, like God. And then he says, when he's asked for a reason, he says, "How can I sin against God and do this evil?" So he was living for God. And God was with him, like God, with God, for God. Can you see that? You know, there are some fights that you're not supposed to win by a knockout. You're supposed to win them by at least 100 meters. Paul says in 2 Timothy, flee youthful lusts. There are some fights you don't stand and fight. You fight them by running, by making like Joseph and running. And this lady got his cloak, but she didn't get his character. She managed to rip his cloak off him, but his character was intact. He lived a holy life before God. And that is one of the big challenges we face in the workplace, in our workplace, just like you faced. Sometimes when we work in a fallen world with fallen people, there's going to be serious temptation. There's going to be serious pressure. There's going to be abuse of power. Has anyone who has power over you ever told you to do something that you don't want to do or that you know you shouldn't do? If you've been in a situation like that, you know it's not easy. But the challenge then is to stand up. Always to stand up. That's part of our witness to God, is being like God and saying, no, I'm living for God. And saying, yes, you have authority over me, you have power over me, but you are under God's authority. God is the higher authority, and I submit first and foremost to His authority. And I'm first and foremost going to do His will. Even if it costs me something. Even if I know I can be discriminated against. Even if I know I can be victimized for this. God will vindicate you. But can you in that situation, like Joseph, trust God to vindicate you if you pay the price to do what is right? Do you have that much trust in God? We ought to have that kind of trust in God. Because God is a faithful God. He won't let us down. He's with us. Now, just another thing. Did you notice that it said that, in fact, I'll get to that when we read the next scripture. God blessed not only Joseph and what he did. He gave Joseph success. So there's some of the fruit that Sharon was talking about. If God blesses you, then there will be some form of success. It might not be exactly the worldly form of success, because yet Joseph is still a slave. And yet what he's doing is prospering. But God didn't only bless Joseph. God blessed the entire household of Potiphar because Joseph was there. Do you realize what that means for you in the workplace? It means that you can expect, because you are God's child and because God is with you, you can expect God not only to bless you where you are. That doesn't mean you're not going to go through tough times or challenges or suffer in any way, but you are going to experience God's blessing despite the challenges. But don't only expect God to bless you, you can expect God to bless the people around you because you're there. God blessed the entire household, his fields, even his children. Everything was blessed because Joseph was there. And I've experienced this, you know. I remember a couple of years ago, it was just after matric, I received a bursary to go and study chemical engineering. And I did what they call exposure year, you know, to go and work for the mines for a year before I went to study. And the second sort of 4 months of the year, the last 4 months of the year, I was actually in Valcom. Started in June, July. It was the coldest I've ever been in my life. Valcom, Bethlehem, those places are cold. And I worked with a guy who was a metallurgist on the plant, on the gold plant. His name was James Buchebner. Still remember his name because he had this interesting name. He was a short little guy with glasses, a thin sort of scrawny guy, and he walked very fast. So they called him Top Speed Buchebner. So you know he would walk these short little fast steps and you know run all across the plant. And he was a bit of a ham, you know. So he was one of those funny guys. Everyone liked joking, you know, and he actually enjoyed it, you know, so sometimes he'd sort of act up, you know, and invite this teasing, you know, so he was this sort of bit of a clown guy. But he was quite a worldly guy, you know, and only one thing on his mind, and that was ladies, you know, and how to, you know, he was a bit like Potiphar's wife, you know. how to get, you know, ladies to bed with him. And when he realized I was a Christian, you know, he would be deliberate. I didn't realize it at that time. I was an 18, 19 year old young guy, you know, and I was, you know, trying to live for the Lord as well as I could. But, you know, when he realized I was a Christian, he'd intentionally provoke me, you know, and tell all kinds of stories of what he did, you know, and who he slept with. And James, I don't want to hear this, you know, and I preach the gospel to him, you know, tell him he needs to repent, you know, and then he'll, you know, nail me all the more, you know, and tell me all kinds of stories. And later on, I realized he was just trying to provoke me, you know. But at the end of my 4 months there, I remember it was the last day, and we had to go. You go through this security checkout, you know. So you have like an overall on the inside, and then you have your clothes on the outside, and you literally take off all your clothes, and you walk through the security check. So they can check you that no one's stealing the gold, you know. And we were sort of on the inside, and we were busy, you know, packing up for the day, packing our stuff in the locker and so on, and finishing up the day, getting ready to go through the security checkpoint. And we're just chatting, you know, and he said, you know, Henny, I can really see that, you know, you things in your life work differently. It's not the same, you know, because, you know, he'd go through lots of issues, a lot of drama always in his life. And he said, you know, you go through things, but it's like you just sort of cruising, you know, everything just seems to work out right for you. And I don't, quite understand it, but I know it's because God is with you. You know, after watching me for 4 months and trying to provoke me and give me a hard time, I don't think I was that great of a testing. I was only an 18, 19-year-old young fellow, and, you know, I didn't know that much. Sometimes, you know, his provocation actually worked on me, and I got very upset with him. But he says, I can see God is with you. And I remember during that time, that gold plant, Joel Gold Plant, had the best numbers it's had up to that time. You know, in terms of gold production and so on. And it was like God was not only blessing me, but God was blessing the whole gold plant because I was there. And I saw the same thing, or a similar thing in Rochelle's life. She was working first for a guy called Peter down in Stellenbosch. He only worked for a few months, and he was a terrible boss. He was one of those bosses from hell. He had a turnover. No one wanted to be his PA. You know, every month or two or three, he'd have a new PA. Now, Rochelle, she was still looking for a job, so she took that job as his PA. She actually stayed with him for a bit longer than the average. I think it was about 4, 5, 6 months. Can't remember. But during that time when she was there, and it was really a hard time. She, in the mornings when I went to drop her off at work, she sometimes cried and said, "I don't want to go. You know, that's how bad it is." But during that time, the Lord blessed that company. Of course, Rochelle was there. And then she went to the CSIR, and they had their best figures while she was there. Because she was there. So we should expect, I don't want to make a rule of this and say hard and fast is always like this, but in some way or another, God will bless you at your work, but also use you as an excuse to bless the people around you at your work. And we should expect that as part of our testimony at work. People must be able to look at our lives and see there's something different. There's a divine hand upon this man's life, upon this woman's life. And they could see it in Joseph's life. Okay. And then Joseph in prison, he was unfairly imprisoned for doing what is right. Can you imagine that? He stood up for what was right. He refused to do what was wrong, and what he got for that was unfair treatment and imprisonment. Imagine how he felt. First, his brothers throw him into a pit and sell him as a slave. Then he comes and he serves as well as he can in Potiphar's house, and he's just trying to be faithful, and then he's betrayed, lied about, framed, basically, and chucked in prison. The Lord continued to be with him. Listen to chapter 39, verse 20, from verse 21. This is amazing. And this is, like I say, a pattern in Joseph's life. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Can you see the pattern? Exactly the same as Potiphar's house. The Lord was with him. And the Lord gave him favor. In other words, even when things are going wrong in our lives, even when we're unfairly treated, even when we're victimized, even when we're framed, if you're unfairly dismissed or something like that, doesn't matter. That's not the end of the world. It would be the end of the world for someone who didn't know the Lord. But if, like Joseph, the Lord is with you, then it doesn't matter, because your success doesn't come from your effort or from the opportunities you grab hold of primarily. It comes primarily from the Lord. And the Lord opens the right doors for you. And sometimes he allows you to go through these things. Clearly, Joseph had to learn certain things. Clearly, some character had to be established in Joseph's life in order for him to be able to fulfill God's calling on his life. And the pit, Potiphar's house, and the prison were all part of the build-up and part of the preparation for the palace. And if Joseph had not gone through the pit, if he'd not served in Potiphar's house, if he'd not been in prison, wrongfully imprisoned, and had to deal with that, and if he'd not served faithfully in prison, he would not have been ready for the palace to fulfill God's calling on his life. Sometimes you'll have to go through things like that as well. Don't be distressed. Don't worry about it. The Lord is with you. He will use that for your good. He's just training you. That's part of your training. It's boot camp. Amen. Notice he continued to serve faithfully, and God gave him success in his service. So he served the warden, and God supernaturally blessed what he was doing. Now, I just want you to think about this, you know. He'd already been betrayed by his brothers and thrown into the pit and sold as a slave. Now he was betrayed by Potiphar's wife, whom he'd just been faithfully serving, and thrown into prison. How would most people respond to that? How would you respond to that? Honestly, I mean, none of, who of you, I'm not going to ask, don't put up your hand, but I mean, very few of us have been in prison. I shouldn't assume that no one's been in prison because someone might have been in prison. But very few of us have been in prison. So we don't know what it's like. And in those dungeons, in those days, there weren't human rights, right? Most people I know would, even many Christians probably, would respond with self-pity. Oh, you know, God, you've forsaken me, you've left me. You know, everything's going wrong in my life. Nothing wants to work. I'm being so unfairly treated. Let me just fall down into a heap and cry myself to sleep. My life is so terrible. I mean, we say that those kind of things in situations that are not nearly as bad as Joseph's situation. We feel so sorry for ourselves, so easily. Listen to this. I love this definition of self-pity. Self-pity is a self-absorbed feeling sorry for oneself, fueled by three things: a high view of self, a low view of God, and an attitude of entitlement. Let me read that again. Self-pity is a self-absorbed feeling sorry for oneself, fueled by a high view of self. I deserve better than this. I'm the central character. I'm the main actor in this play. Why am I not being treated like the main man? A low view of God. Surely God can't be working in the midst of this or through this. God is watching me from a distance, like Bette Midler sings, but He's not really involved in my life. A low view of God and an attitude of entitlement. I deserve this. In a human rights culture, which focuses exclusively almost on rights and not on responsibilities, this is a huge problem, this attitude of entitlement. And we're all susceptible to it. I have rights. I deserve better. We're all susceptible to that. And therefore, we are all susceptible to self-pity. How do you respond when you're going through hard times? How do you respond when God's will for your life takes you into situations that you don't like, that are not comfortable, and that you had not planned, and that you had that you'd rather not be in? Situations where you've been unfairly treated. How do you respond? Do you respond with self-pity? Sometimes I do. I'm sure many of us do. Joseph didn't. What did Joseph do? He just served where God had placed him. And you know what God did? God blessed him. So much so that this warden said, you know, I don't need to run this prison. This guy does it better than me. Let me sit back and relax and let him run the prison. So you have a prisoner running the prison. Faithfully. He's faithfully serving where he is. And God is blessing him for it. And then we all know the story of how the baker and the cupbearer have these two dreams, and that sort of shifts things. But I just want you to notice, and this is also a theme, you know, another theme in Joseph's life is the whole theme of prophecy. Remember, the whole thing started with two dreams that he had. The dream of the sheaf bowing down to his brother's sheaves bowing down to his sheaf, and the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowing down to him. That dream, prophecy, prophetic dream. Then he has this, the situation where the baker and the cupbearer have these dreams. And both of them, it says in 3 days something will happen. The cupbearer will be restored and he will once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. He was like the taster, you know, he would taste everything before, you know, to make sure there's no poison, you know. And the baker, in 3 days he'll be killed. And it happened exactly like that. And he says to the cupbearer, you know, when this happens, don't forget me. When you've been restored and you once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, tell Pharaoh about me. Tell him I've been wrongfully imprisoned, you know. And you know what? This guy forgets about it. For 2 years. For more than 2 years. And then you have a situation where Pharaoh eventually has a dream. Two dreams, actually. Once again, two dreams that tell the same thing. The seven fat cows swallowed up by the seven thin cows, representing 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And the seven grains of wheat, the sort of fat grains of wheat swallowed up by the sort of withered grains of wheat, representing the same thing. And then also, let me just read you this one passage in 42 verse 9, Genesis 42 verse 9. It says, then he remembered his dream. This is when Joseph's brothers come before him. Joseph remembered his dreams about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. And they know, and they protest and so on. But can you see this theme of how prophetic dreams play an important role in Joseph's life? And I think there is a place where God does prophetically, through stuff like dreams, reveal our calling to us. Because that's what God did for Joseph right at the beginning. He showed him he's going to make him a ruler and his whole family is going to bow down to him. And it happened exactly like that. So prophecy is important. Then Joseph in the palace, like I said, after he'd interpreted these dreams for the baker and the cupbearer, the cupbearer went and he served Pharaoh for 2 years, forgetting about Joseph. But then the Pharaoh had these dreams and no one could interpret them for him. And then the cupbearer remembered. Oh, you know, Pharaoh, there was this Hebrew slave in this prison. You know, when you were angry with me, you put me in prison. There was this Hebrew slave and the baker and I, we each had a dream, different dreams, which had an interpretation. And this young Hebrew guy interpreted both dreams for us. And it happened exactly like he said. And just by the way, I think interpreting dreams is also a part of a type of prophetic gift, which Joseph clearly had. Okay, so Joseph has this gift. So they call him, and Joseph comes before Pharaoh. He shaves, puts on new clothes, you know, makes himself respectable, and he comes before Pharaoh. And let me just read to you in 41 from verse 17. It says, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, in my dream, I was standing on the banks of the Nile, on the bank of the Nile, when out of the Nile there came up seven cows, fat and sleek. They grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows came up, scrawny and very ugly and lean. I had never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt. The lean, ugly cows ate up the seven fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell that they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. And I woke up, and then he told them the second dream as well. And I just want you to notice one thing in let me just read verse 37 to you. It says, where Joseph is interpreting the dream, he says, the plan seemed good he said to him, here we go, in verse 28, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The reason the dreams are given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. So here, he says at the beginning, this Pharaoh says to him, you must just hear a dream and then you can interpret it. He says, no, I can't do that, but God can. God is the one that gives the interpretation. Can you see that even here in front of Pharaoh, he is giving testimony to God? He's witnessing to God. And that's another theme in Joseph's life. And I'm just going to go back a bit quickly and show you some of that. But Joseph is constantly, clearly witnessing to the Lord, to Yahweh, to God, to his God, wherever he is, whether it's going well or whether it's not going well. In chapter 39, verse 3, it says, when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, he found favor. How did he know about the Lord? Well, Joseph had clearly told him. He clearly told him, I am a servant of Yahweh. This is the Egyptian that doesn't know about Yahweh. But here he says, I am a servant of Yahweh. So that when he succeeded, his Egyptian master knew where the credit belonged. It belonged with his God. with Yahweh. There's something supernatural about this boy. Yes, he's talented, but there's more. His God is clearly giving him success. So he witnessed. In verse 9 it says, no one is greater than me in the house. My master is withheld nothing from me except you. And he says to Potiphar's wife, how can I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Even in this situation of temptation, he's witnessing for God. He's saying, listen here, God is watching me. If I do this, I won't only be sinning against you and against my master. I'd be sinning first and foremost against God, my God. So he's constantly bringing God into the discussion. In 40 verse 8, it says, we both had dreams. They answered, but there is no one who can interpret them for us. And then Joseph said to them, this is to the baker and the cupbearer in prison, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. So he's looking for situations where God is clearly intervening supernaturally. And notice that these, the cupbearer and the baker are not Christians. They're not Jews. They're not worshippers of God. They're not saved in any kind of way. And yet God speaks to them through dreams. Hello? Did you know God can do that? And he's looking, Joseph is looking out for these supernatural situations where God is already at work and intervening so that he can witness and say, but it's God has given you that dream and God will give you the interpretation. Tell me your dream. And then in 41 verse 15 and 16 it says, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream and no one could interpret it. But I've heard that you, it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. And he says, I cannot, Joseph said, I cannot do it. He replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. God will give you, I can do it, but God will give you the answer. So he once again saw this as a supernatural intervention of God and God giving him an opportunity to witness to the king of the land, to Pharaoh himself. Says, I can do this, but God can. Watch him. And then in verse 25, it says, and Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. This whole situation is God doing. Who's the main actor in the story of Joseph? God is. He's the one that takes Joseph from the pit to Potiphar's house, to prison, to the palace. And he's the one that brings the famine. The 7 good years and the 7 lean years. God is the one doing it. That's what God is about to do. So he brings God into the discussion again. In verse 28, it says, just as I said to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. In verse 32, it says, the reason the dreams are given to Pharaoh in two forms is because the matter has been decided by God and God will do it soon. In verse 38 to 39, it says, the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man? One in whom is the Spirit of God. Speaking about Joseph. Pharaoh and his officials could see the Spirit of God upon Joseph. And they knew it was the Spirit of God. Because God, Joseph was constantly talking about God and giving God the credit and witnessing for God. No matter where he was, whether it was in Potiphar's house, whether it was in prison, or whether he was standing before the king in the palace. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You take charge of the country. And he made him second in command of all of Egypt, put the whole of Egypt under his rule. And therefore under God's rule. And there's one more interesting one. This is a bit later when Joseph's brothers come and they come back the second time and they're afraid because Joseph had put their silver back into their bags the first time. And they're worried that, because they don't know it's Joseph, of course. In verse 43, verse 23, listen to this one. This is a good one. They come to the steward of Joseph's household. Now remember, he's second in command. He's the governor of all of Egypt. He's a powerful man now. They've been bowing down to him just like the dream said they would. They don't know it's Joseph and they're afraid. You know, they think, okay, this guy's going to overpower us and take our donkeys and make us his slaves because he thinks we stole his money. And they go to the steward and say, listen, last time the money was put back, here's the money, please take it, you know. And listen to what he says. He says, it's all right, said the steward. Don't be afraid. Listen to this. Your God and the God of your fathers has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver, talking about the first time. Then he brought some men out to them. Here, an Egyptian servant in Joseph's house is witnessing towards God and what God is doing. Why? Because he spent so much time with Joseph. And that was what Joseph did. He talked about God. So much so that his servants, who are Egyptian servants, seem to have converted now. And they were saying, no, don't you worry. It's the God, your God, and the God of your fathers who is blessing you. Don't be afraid. You're not in trouble. Joseph witnessed for God. Are we looking out for opportunities in our workplace, wherever we are, whether it's going well or not so well, to witness? I mean, think about this. Often we think about only, this is a mistake we often make, not only in the workplace, but in church as well. We only think about the good things that are happening in our lives as part of our witness. Right? You shouldn't only be telling people and speaking about God when things are going well in your life. You should be, when things are going wrong, tell people about it. Say, listen, this is going wrong, but I'm praying about it. I'm asking God to give me mercy or to help me and to show me the way out here. So that when God answers that prayer, you can tell. Remember? When people ask you, here's one of your cues that you're supposed to, or one of the best opportunities to witness. When someone says to you, how are you? Or how's it going? Don't say fine. Don't say fine. At that stage, you should have told them about what's difficult in your life and how you're praying about it so that you can give a testimony about what God has done and is doing. Say, well, it wasn't going so well. But this is what God has done and this is what God is doing. And this was what I'm trusting God for. Okay. Then another thing is, notice another theme. This is the theme in Joseph's life. Joseph constantly forgave the people who sinned against him. He forgave Potiphar's wife for trying to seduce him and then framing him and lying about him and getting him thrown in prison. He forgave the cupbearer for forgetting about him for 2 years. And he forgave his brothers for selling him in as a slave. Remember, he's made second in command of all of Egypt. Now he's the one with the power. He can go back to Potiphar's wife and say, remember me. Huh? I'm the little Hebrew slave, outsider that you framed. You remember me? Let's talk about what happened that day. He didn't do that. He didn't go and avenge himself. You know, when he was made second in command, he didn't go to the cupbearer and say, Kumbikiso. 2 years, buddy. 2 years, you forgot about that. I was rotting in prison. No, because he recognized even that, even the cupbearer's forgetting was part of God's plan. Because the cupbearer forgot until Pharaoh had his dreams and until Pharaoh was ready to hear the interpretation. God is in control of Joseph's life. Do you believe he's in control of yours? Often we don't. You know, when his brothers came to buy him wheat, he could have said to them, you sold me as a slave. Not only am I not going to give you wheat, I'm going to kill you. You hated me? What's happened? Watch what happens to people who hate me. He didn't do that. He forgave all of them. And he treated them the way they didn't deserve to be treated, with grace. Okay, there are some more things that I could have said about this, but I just want to end off with this one thing. The theme that, and slowly but surely, as things progressed, Joseph didn't realize this at the beginning when he got the dreams, and his brothers certainly didn't realize that. But slowly but surely, everyone comes to the realization that God is in control of all of this. Listen to what his brothers say in Genesis 28, verse 28. 42, verse 28. This is when they've come back to buy grain. He says, my silver has been returned. He said to his brothers, here it is in my sack. And their hearts sank. This is when they're on the way back from the first buying the grain. Their hearts sank and they turned to each other trembling, saying, what is this that God has done to us? They're starting to realize that God is involved here. God is in control here. In chapter 45, verse 5, listen to this. This is where Joseph has just revealed himself, made himself known to his brothers. He says, and now do not be distressed. Remember how distressed I was in the pit? But I don't want you to be distressed. Don't be distressed. And do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. You sold me as a slave, but guess what? You selling me as a slave was God sending me ahead of you to save your lives. God was in control. And then the last one in Genesis 50 verse 16. This is after Jacob died. And now his brothers are afraid again. Oh, you know, maybe now that our father's dead, you know, Joseph's going to kill us because he was just holding out and being merciful to us for his father, for our father's sake. But now that dad's gone, he's going to take vengeance on us. And listen to what it says. And they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. And they're lying, of course. Their father left no such instructions. This is what you should say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers and the sins and the wrongs that they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they said. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? In other words, am I the one in control? Am I God? No. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what has now been done to save many lives. You're sinning against me and selling me as a slave and lying about me. Potiphar's wife sinning against me and framing me. Me being in prison, being forgotten in prison for more than 2 years. All of that was God working to bring about salvation. And all of that happened to prepare me for my calling, which is what I'm doing now, and to enable me to fulfill my calling. Last week, Andres was preaching about Romans 8. Remember that verse in Romans 8, verse 28? For God can make all things work together for the good of those who love Him, who are the called according to His purpose. And we should expect God to do that in our lives. Think about this. Just think about this. There are lots of parallels between the life of Joseph and the life of Jesus. Jesus was also betrayed by his brothers. Right? Jesus was also betrayed by his brothers. Jesus was also sold for silver. Remember? Judas sold him for 30 pieces of silver. Jesus also suffered in order to save those who had betrayed him, which includes us. And in all of that, in all of what was happening to Jesus, in all of his suffering, just like with Joseph, God was working out his plan of salvation. So I want to read you two scriptures in the book of Acts, where just like Joseph and his brothers, the apostles look back and they see this. In Acts 2 verse 23, it says, this man, that's Jesus, was handed over to you by God's purpose and foreknowledge. And you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. And the greatest sin in the history of mankind was planned by God for our salvation. Listen to what chapter 4, verse 27 and 28 says. Indeed, Herod, this is the disciples praying after being threatened by the Jewish leaders. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did whatever your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. With wicked hands, they took the innocent Son of God and murdered him. And did, by doing so, did exactly what God had planned. Just like Joseph's brothers. Now, my question is, if God can do that in Joseph's life, can He not do that in our lives too? Do we not sometimes give God too little credit? Do we not sometimes underestimate God's involvement in our lives? Isn't God at work in your life right now where you are working? Whether it's comfortable or not, whether it's easy or not, whether you're suffering or not, whether you're being successful in the eyes of the world or not, isn't God working in your situation? I think maybe He is. Maybe we just don't always notice it. And just like Joseph was sent ahead of his brothers to save them, so Jesus was sent ahead of us to save us. And His body was broken so that we can be saved. And His blood was shed so that we can be forgiven. And Jesus was willing to suffer all of that. And just like Joseph forgave those who had betrayed Him, Jesus hangs on the cross and He forgives us and He says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing," while His body was being broken for us.